The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry, and we thank you so much for listening. This year, more people around the world have been displaced from their homes than at any time since the Second World War. They've left South Sudan and Myanmar, Eritrea, Iraq, and Syria, fleeing war and oppression. Most have headed for Europe by land or sea. Thousands have died along the way. But for these refugees, arriving in Europe isn't the end of their struggles. They have to get asylum and resettlement. And here's a number that may startle you. Of the more than 1 million refugees who've arrived in the EU, only 190 have been formally relocated. Obstacles, both bureaucratic and political, are causing huge backlogs. The epicenter of the crisis is in Germany, where an estimated 1.1 million asylum seekers have arrived, though a number of those are from the Balkans. In Berlin, a crowd outside the city's administrative complex is filled with refugees from around the world. One man named Amar told our producer, Thalia Beatty, that he'd spent the night in the street waiting in line to register his application.
There's something not logical. There's something, I don't know. And where are we? In Germany, the most organized, most democratic country. I don't know. It's strange.
Even for Syrians who have registered as refugees, there are still long waits and complex systems to navigate. Another refugee in Berlin, Jamal Dasuki, was beside himself with frustration after being told he'd waited at the wrong office.
I have papers that need to be stamped so that my children can go to school. I want to buy them books and notebooks and everything. I've been here since 4 a.m., and now they throw me out and say, not here. Okay, you sent me here. How can you tell me it's not here?
He's a Palestinian who was living in Syria until the war broke out, and now he's wondering where to turn.
I have done everything I can from beginning to end to get my children into school, so they are not sitting at home, so they can learn the language. Okay, if the state isn't helping me, who will? Who can I appeal to?
The crisis has put bureaucratic and political pressure on Europe's institutions. In a moment, we'll talk about a rightward shift in Poland's government that's added to the uncertainty there. But first, a look at Germany and other European countries and how they're coping with these asylum seekers and migrants. Ambassador William Lacy Swing is Director General of the International Organization for Migration, and he joins me now. Ambassador, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Germany has taken in about 1.1 million refugees so far, about 125,000 a month, if not more. Talk about some of the hurdles, logistical and bureaucratic, even political, that are holding up so many of the placements here.
Well, I think, first of all, Europe was, frankly, a little bit behind the curve in regard to these migrants, because we've known for a long time, since the disaster off Lampedusa in October 2013, in which nearly 400 people lost their lives, that with 5 years of conflict in Syria and almost unmitigated conflict from West Africa to the Himalayas, that a lot of people would start heading north. It's taken them a while to get ready for this. They're now getting, I think, on with the relocation scheme. The numbers are being relocated are too small, and much of the pressure, as you mentioned, has therefore fallen upon Germany. In addition, you have winter now, which means different requirements. We're doing what we can, all of us are, to help register the people, to make sure that they're properly fed and helped. But it is a major task for the countries.
What are conditions like now for most of the unsettled asylum seekers and migrants in Germany? Where are they living and what is life like for them?
Well, I think Germany, as much as anyone, is doing, I think, a superb job of bringing these people into good shelter, making sure that they're warm, that they're fed, taken good care of. They are probably better prepared than anyone else in Europe right now. And we must praise Chancellor Merkel for her very courageous and visionary decision to take in large numbers of refugees, knowing that there was great need there. Unfortunately, not all of the other 27 EU member states chose to follow her. In fact, very few, and that's unfortunate.
We're going to talk in a couple of minutes about the rightward political shift in Poland, part of it due to the migration crisis and other influences as well. How does the shifting politics in some of these countries, Poland and others, affect the situation and complicate it for countries like Germany and other countries across the EU that are trying to deal with this crisis?
Well, it makes it more difficult. I mean, for example, you had four countries of the 28 who decided in September to basically say no to the relocation scheme, and one further country abstained, which puts more pressure on those who are willing to accept large numbers. Because if it were divided along any kind of an equitable basis, a million migrants is less than 0.5% of the population of 550 million. So if there were unity here, then I think the load would be definitely manageable. I mean, our belief is that it's much less a crisis to be managed than a human reality that has to be managed.
And how much is a unified EU policy necessary here? I mean, it's one thing for individual governments to have their own individual political episodes and imperatives, and I think that's expected. But there have been so many problems with unified EU strategy across this crisis, where it's been very difficult to coordinate intake and agreements between the countries.
Absolutely. It's very much less a migrant crisis than a crisis of union and a crisis of leadership. There is unfortunately also a growing anti-migrant sentiment that's fairly widespread, and this makes it very difficult. And we keep trying to say that we must not have refugee amnesia. We mustn't forget that my organization and the UN High Commission for Refugees were both created in 1951 precisely to take Europeans ravaged by the Second World War to safe shores and new lives in the U.S., Canada, and Australia. So this is, it seems to me, is extremely important. And I think the European Union itself, the Commission and the Council, are doing a very good job of trying to lead on this. But as you say, the member states then have to follow. Partly it's a psychological adjustment, because for four centuries, European nations and many others were continents of origin, and now they've become, for four decades, continents of destination. And that requires a psychological adjustment that requires leadership.
Back to Germany just for one moment and the 1.1 million refugees that they've agreed to take in. It's been a huge logistical hurdle. Do you have the anticipation now that Germany is going to be able to properly place each and every one of those people by the end of this or by the end of 2016?
That's a hard calculation for us to make from our vantage point. We have a role, but a fairly modest role in all of this. We certainly look upon Germany as one of our key partners, and I think if anyone can do it, they will be able to do it. They have the capacity to do it, and they seem to have had very good support at the local level, but that is always under pressure as the numbers mount.
Ambassador, thank you for your time.
You're most welcome. Thank you very much.
Ambassador William Lacey Swing is Director General of the International Organization for Migration. The anti-refugee sentiment across Europe helped cause a power shift in Poland this past October. The right-wing nationalist Law and Justice Party won elections there and is now being accused of weakening and in some cases dismantling many of the country's democratic institutions. That includes the military leadership, the state media, even the highest judicial body in the country called the Constitutional Court. Kim Lane Shipley is professor of international affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. She says Poland's power grab is exposing weaknesses in the larger European Union and that it's a move taken straight from a familiar playbook.
So Poland is actually following in the footsteps of Hungary and also Romania. In both cases, what you had were governments whose leaders decided essentially that they didn't want rotation of power to ever occur again, that they wanted to stay in power forever and they wanted their political parties to stay in power forever. So it started in Hungary with Viktor Orban's government that was elected in 2010. And he launched a takeover of all the independent institutions in Hungary, putting loyalists into all of them, concentrating power, basically setting up a system so that it would be impossible for the opposition ever to come back into power again. And then Victor Ponta in Romania, who, by the way, is on the left, not on the right, tried to do the same thing by ousting the president of the country, who was from a different party. And now you see Poland following suit. And what's very interesting is that all of the leaders of all of these three countries that I just mentioned are all lawyers. In fact, I call this the problem of the lawyers in chief, that you've got lawyers and what they do is they use the law to gain power, to concentrate power, and to rewrite the rules so that no one else can come to power. We've seen it play out in Hungary, and now we're seeing a grab in Poland that looks a whole lot more like the grab for power in Hungary. And one of the questions is whether the Polish revolution, this sort of constitutional revolution, will succeed.
Is there a danger to the EU here? There's a broad consensus within the European Union countries about respect for constitutional institutions, checks and balances, those types of things. There's certainly room for political changes. We've seen that. Does the EU have a say here? And if not, does that drive Poland back towards the east?
Well, when all of these countries joined in 2004, these post-communist countries, many of their populations thought the EU would prevent them from sliding back into a dictatorship again. But now that we've seen these changes in Hungary and now Poland, what you see is that the EU's powers to actually change the internal affairs of member states are very limited. Countries were checked on their way in the door to join the EU by, you know, demonstrating when they joined that they were democracies and respected rule of law and had protections for human rights. All that was checked when they came in the door. But now we see that there's no mechanism for checking any of these countries' continued adherence to those principles once they're in. So it's very much a crisis like the euro crisis, or for that matter, like the migration crisis this summer, open borders but no common immigration policy, where the EU builds in sort of a half-baked institution. And to make it fully baked, you'd need a kind of integration that the other member states won't put up with.
Can the European Union threaten expulsion or sanction? Is there any step they can take, or do they just have to sit and watch with alarm?
You'd think that if you have a misbehaving member state, that the EU could throw them out. But the fact is, in the European treaties, there is no mechanism for throwing out a misbehaving state. And in fact, its tools are very limited. In fact, right now, there's not even an easy way for the EU to cut the substantial funding it gives to these member states that are misbehaving. There are really no sanctions built into the EU system right now that are very clearly designed for this kind of purpose. So at the moment, since there are no sanctions built for this purpose, the European Commission is trying desperately to figure out what it can do. And we're all hoping that it actually improvises something, because this is now a disease that's spreading.
In terms of the refugee crisis, one of the effects of what's happening in Poland, and this isn't a surprise, is that the new government has reversed any of the decisions of the previous government to take in Middle Eastern refugees. How much pressure is this putting on the rest of Europe, notably on Germany, which is having its own trouble placing all of the many thousands, tens of thousands, if not hundreds, of refugees that it's agreed to take?
Yes. Well, right now, actually, just this week, the 1 millionth refugee entered the EU. And Poland has now decided it's not going to take any after the previous government committed it to taking some. But it's not alone in this regard. The so-called Visegrad states, Poland, Slovakia, Czech Republic, and Hungary, have all actually refused to take any additional refugees. So the EU, again, has a big crisis on its hands, because it can't really fight so many different countries at the same time.
Professor Shepley, you made it clear that the EU has very few tools, sanctions, things that it can do to intervene or force Poland or Hungary to rethink some of these politics. But you also said that change of power is normal in democracy. Is waiting it out an option, as painful as that is, waiting 8 to 10 years and sort of enticing Poland and or Hungary and other countries in the East back into the fold with new elections?
Certainly that's been our hope, that elections will result in more sane policies from each of these countries. But the worry about Poland and Hungary is that in both cases, there's been a massive assault on the constitutional structure itself. And this massive assault on the constitutional structure means that you can't necessarily count on elections actually fixing things. So if we take Hungary, which started on this troublesome course in 2010, the Hungarian government rewrote all the election laws so that when they came up for election in 2014 with substantially diminished support, they nonetheless won back their constitutional supermajority because they'd managed to rewrite all the rules. Now, the current government in Poland has only been in power for 2 months, but when you see them starting to dismantle the operation of the constitutional court, they've taken over the leadership of the military, they're just about to launch a major assault on public broadcasting and the media. It's the same kind of disabling of all the checks on their power that one can take as a danger signal, because what they're trying to do is to set up a government that provides absolutely no barriers to them doing absolutely anything. And if that's the case, then what's to prevent them from, again, rigging the election law so that they will win any conceivable election? Once that happens, you can't really count on elections fixing the problem.
The right-wing Nationalist Law and Justice Party in power in Poland, replicating a playbook already used in Hungary and in other cases, and spreading a crisis throughout the EU. Professor Kim Lane Shepley of the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, funding cancer research across the continuum, from basic research through clinical trials to advanced therapies that save thousands of lives. More information is available at lls.org.
On Wednesday, prosecutors in Pennsylvania filed criminal charges against Bill Cosby in connection with a 2004 sexual assault.
Charges today are filed as a result of new information that came to light in July of 2015. Statute of limitations in this type of case is 12 years. After determining that the statute of limitations regarding potential criminal offenses had not yet expired, the investigation was reopened.
That's Kevin Steele. He's the Montgomery County District Attorney-elect, speaking Wednesday at a press conference. Cosby was charged with aggravated indecent assault. That's a felony carrying a prison term of 5 to 10 years and a $25,000 fine in Pennsylvania. The comedian was arraigned Wednesday afternoon. He's currently free after posting bail and turning over his passport. Marcy Hamilton is professor at Cardoza School of Law in New York and at the University of Pennsylvania, and an attorney specializing in rape and child sex abuse cases. Marcy, you told us yesterday that politics plays an important role here.
It did. Basically, what happened is that Bruce Castor, who was DA when Ms. Constant first reported the rape, basically listened to both sides and concluded that it was a he said, she said situation and that he just couldn't go forward. But even worse, he implied that basically this was just a benign mistake by Cosby.
And if you go back to the campaign, let's listen for a second. Here's a campaign ad from Kevin Steele when he was running for the position that he now holds.
For district attorney in Montgomery County, Kevin Steele. First assistant DA with a 98% conviction rate and tough sentences for sexual predators. Or Bruce Castor, a former DA who refused to prosecute Bill Cosby. Castor said, "We don't charge people for making a mistake or doing something foolish." Many more victims came forward, and Castor admitted he could have used their testimony against Cosby. But Castor didn't even try. Bruce Castor was not looking out for the victims.
Marcy Hamilton, there's no question then that in this local campaign for DA in Montgomery County, this was a huge issue.
It was huge, and it was a game changer. Finally, we have changed the rape culture so that now it matters if someone did not prosecute a powerful man in earlier years, and it's okay to stand with the women. And so this was a huge change. It shows the electorate is also becoming much more sophisticated about these issues.
But it also shows that Cosby's defense is well aware of the politics here and may make an issue of it. His defense attorneys issued a statement last night saying that the charges came on the heels of a hotly contested election for this county's DA, during which this case was made a focal point. Does that mean that Cosby at trial says this is all just Kevin Steele's political promise and nothing more?
The problem for Cosby is that he has been in the headlines for several years now. Over 50 women have come forward with identical stories. But he has a special problem in this case because he was arguing in the civil case that she was a potential sex partner and he knew who was interested in him. So when she took the drugs, it was part of being consensual. It turns out she's gay. And so there's no way that she was sexually attracted to him. And so this may be the strongest case that's out there, and it just so happens to be the only one in the statute of limitations.
There's been a lot of discussion already about the deposition that you're referring to, which was given in the civil suit between Bill Cosby and Ms. Constant back in 2005. So that's going to be an important part of evidence here. It says in that deposition, Bill Cosby admitted that he gave her Quaaludes. If the evidence ends there, however, he says, yes, I gave her Quaaludes, but it was consensual. She says, no, it wasn't. What do the contours of a criminal trial look like in front of a jury?
Well, the criminal trial is more difficult than a civil case because this prosecutor is going to have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he, in fact, digitally raped her rather than they had some fun together. His story is that all 50 women were basically enjoying their time with him. All 50 women are saying, no, actually, we were incapacitated. The problem for him in this case, among others, is that it's possible for the prosecutor to call some of these other women in. Now, no judge is going to let over 50 women come in. That would be prejudicial. No one would be even listening to the facts of this case anymore. But even if two or three are allowed to come in with similar facts, it's going to be very hard for him to say it was just politics and that this is just anti-Cosby animus.
How does the judge decide which of the dozens of women are allowed to testify and which are not?
He has some discretion as to whether or not it would be prejudicial or it would be relevant. And so there's some judgment to be had there. If there were just one other woman, it might be up in the air. With 50 out there and Kevin Steele, the DA, asking for any other women in the area to come forward, I think it's possible that at least a handful could be permitted to testify. And if that happens, Bill Cosby's defense of this is just going after me is going to completely fall apart.
Let's talk about Bill Cosby's defense for a second, because clearly this is going to be the best defense that money can buy. He's got unlimited resources. He showed in all of these other cases a willingness to use those resources. So this is not your average defense. He can afford every lawyer and every motion available to him.
He can, but despite his wealth, and it's reported to be around $400 million, in a court of law, all he has is the facts that he can try to bring up against her. And she has been extremely credible. He has already conceded that he gave her the drugs. And as I said earlier, she is gay. And so this was not something where she was trying to manipulate him into having a relationship. So I think the forces have configured to make it a very, very difficult case for him.
This is going to be an extremely high-profile trial. There's no question about it. Where does it go from here, Marcy Hamilton? We have the arraignment now. What's the timeline until motions start, and how long before an actual trial starts?
Well, motions will start early in 2016, but the trial is not likely to be for 9 to 12 months. And there will be pressure on Cosby to avoid the spectacle of this kind of a trial and to come in with some kind of plea deal. The problem is going to be that he could be sentenced up to 10 years, although on average it would be about 2 to 3 years. And he probably doesn't want to go to jail. So maybe he's willing to take some kind of deal to avoid jail time.
All right, Marcy Hamilton, professor at Cardozo School of Law in New York and the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Widespread flooding in Missouri this week has forced the evacuation of a number of towns, closed major stretches of highways, and killed upwards of 14 people. It's being considered the worst flood the region has seen in decades. And while the rain appears to have subsided, the rivers continued to rise throughout last night. Doug Moore has been reporting on the flooding for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and he joins me now to talk about the latest. Doug, welcome.
Hello, Todd.
Last night was supposed to be the height of the damage when the Mississippi River and the Merrimack River crested. What happened?
Yeah, it did. We do have another interstate that was closed this morning. They're not sure how long it's going to remain closed. So they are having to detour traffic and are asking people to stay home if possible, and if not, to take an alternate route. So that is affecting, you know, thousands of motorists on that road of Interstate 55.
Now, you got up in a helicopter yesterday to survey the damage from above. Describe what you saw.
Yeah, it was actually my second day. I'm going up again, day three. It's the best way for us to really convey to our readers what's the extent of the damage. And you really see from that perspective just how widespread the flooding is. The Merrimack River, which is the largest culprit, it runs through most of the counties in the St. Louis region, just could not handle the water, which rose over a course of 3 days, 4 days, 35 feet, if you can imagine that. So the banks of the river just could not support it. So we saw widespread flooding in a half dozen suburban communities, yards, homes, barns, So there were hundreds of people that were forced from their homes, evacuated, moved to higher ground.
The flooding is affecting mostly smaller towns along the banks of the river?
It is. The city of St. Louis is situated right on the Mississippi, and there haven't been any homes displaced there just because it's a larger river. But the Merrimack River is a smaller version of that runs through. It's a tributary of the Mississippi. And so, it's those smaller communities that are most affected by this. But that adds up to several thousand people.
And how have locals evaluated the rescue efforts so far?
Successful. The injuries have been minor, a little hypothermia. People have been outside too long or waded into the water when they probably shouldn't have. But they've been able to put them into shelters or with relatives. And they've done a pretty good job of making sure that everyone is out of their homes. There's a few holdouts that just won't leave their homes, and there's not much they can do about that. But by and large, people have been cooperative and moved to warm, dry places.
Doug Moore, put this into the historical context for us. I mentioned that this is the worst flooding in decades. There were some floods in 1992, back in the early 80s. How does this stack up in terms of what the region has seen over the last 30 or 40 years?
At least in the last 20, 25 years, this is the worst we've seen it, just in sort of its scope. We had a flood in 1993 that was huge, mainly because of the Mississippi. But the fact that we've had so many rivers, so many towns affected by this in such a short period of time because of so much rain that came 8 to 10 inches, within a 2 to 3 day period. The forecasters, the meteorologists are calling this historic.
And Doug, are the forecasters telling you that the worst for this episode is probably over now?
Yes and no. I mean, the rivers have crested in some parts of our region, but actually there's a little anxiety still going on because in some parts of the region, it's not going to crest until the end of the day Thursday. So there's sandbaggers standing by waiting to see if their work is going to be a success or not. So we're going to be back up in the sky today, taking a look at what's going on and giving people another sense of how the damage is and how it's changed in the last 24 hours.
Massive flooding along the Merrimack and Mississippi rivers in Missouri. Doug Moore reporting from the ground and from above for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Doug, thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by scientists that has been used by 70 million people worldwide, with training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
What year is it?
35 years from now, you reprogrammed me to be your protector here. This time.
Now I need your help to get back to the year 1985.
Hot tub time machine.
You maniac! You blew it up!
New Year's Eve 2015, we're looking back at the best movies of the year that was with our Movie Date team, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer, of course, culture producer here at The Takeaway. Together they are the Movie Date podcast team. Welcome, Kristen and Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
Hi, Todd.
Of course, when I'm here and you guys are here, it's trivia time. This is special New Year's Eve edition of Movie Trivia. Listen to this clip from a famous New Year's Eve scene in a movie. Don't give your answer. We're going to save it for the end.
Ahora nombro un gobierno provisional. Salud. Salud. Salud.
That's New Year's Eve in a famous film, in a famous scene. Name the film. All right, now you guys have each brought your top three films of the year, Rafer and Kristen. I think common to both of your lists is one of my favorite movies of the year, Mad Max Fury Road. Listen to this.
How do you know this place even exists?
I was born there.
So why'd you leave?
I didn't. I was taken as a child. Stolen.
I love this movie, the war drums, the heavy metal guitarist going into battle. The whole thing start to finish just drove me nuts. It was awesome.
It's just unstoppable, isn't it? I mean, George Miller, the director who did Road Warrior all those years ago, comes back. He's 71 years old. You'd think he was 13. He just directs this movie like there's no tomorrow. It's just nonstop action from start to finish. I don't know what that accent is that Tom Hardy's doing there, but I don't care. I love this movie.
Kristen.
It's beautiful. It's terrifying. I found it completely engrossing. And you gotta love Charlize Theron in this movie. She's so fierce. You want her on your side. You want her to kill everybody for you. You want her to teach you her tricks so that you can kill everybody too. just great fun, great ride, and again, very scary.
Yeah, and between the two of them, Charlize Theron and Tom Hardy, I didn't know which one was the Road Warrior.
I think it's her.
Okay. Now, Rafer, speaking of intense movies, you have Revenant on your list. This is a new film with Leonardo DiCaprio.
My dad was my boy, and he took him from me, you understand? Knows how far I came to find
them. Deep whisper there from Leonardo. That's intense, too.
That might be all the dialogue in the entire film right there. This is the story of Hugh Glass. DiCaprio plays Hugh Glass, a real-life frontiersman who was mauled by a bear and then has to drag himself back to civilization 200 miles across the open terrain. Great movie, amazing filmmaking. Again, very much like Mad Max, you can't believe these action sequences. Many of them all done in a single take. Stuff that's going on that you can't believe someone choreographed these things from start to finish. It's an amazing, amazing film. Very intense, very macho, and I loved it.
Decidedly unmacho now, Kristen. We're going to throw the brakes on from Fury Road and Revenant because on your top list of the year is Grandma with Lily Tomlin.
Why didn't you use a condom? Or for humanity's sake, get a vasectomy?
What? What did she just say?
She didn't say anything, okay?
Look, she said it wasn't her time. Oh, yeah.
Her time? What are you, a moron? What are you, both morons? Don't they teach kids sex ed anymore?
Kristen.
Oh, I love that Lily Tomlin. Love her so much. In this film, she's playing this eccentric, bossy, opinionated, artistic woman whose granddaughter approaches her and says, I need an abortion, Grandma. Can you help me? So they go on a road trip. They meet all the people from Lily Tomlin's past, and you find out how she came to be this gruff, eccentric woman and how she came to be the woman that you come to when you need an abortion. And she's just so fantastic in this. I couldn't help but just be excited for Lily Tomlin all over again. I loved her as much in this as I did in 9 to 5 back when I was a kid.
Yeah, that's Grandma with Lily Tomlin, directed by Paul Weitz. Now, Rafer, as much as you love the macho, your top movie of the year is actually Inside Out from Pixar. Not too macho. Listen.
You know what I realized? Riley hasn't had lunch. Remember?
Hey, I saw a pizza place down the street. Maybe we could try that.
Pizza sounds delicious.
Pizza? Pizza.
Yes, pizza.
Right, that's good. What the heck is that?
Who puts broccoli on pizza?
That's it. I'm done.
Congratulations, San Francisco. You've ruined pizza.
I heard Louis Black at the end there, Rafer Guzman, as all of Riley's emotions, joy, fear, anger, disgust, and sadness, chime in about pizza.
That's right. Most of this movie takes place inside that little girl's head. She's moved to a new town. She's very unhappy. She's having a hard time. And joy and sadness, that's played by Amy Poehler and Phyllis Smith. They go missing inside her personality. They have to find their way back into her mind and recontrol her emotions. I just think it's such a wonderful film and such an interesting idea that shows how the real world affects what goes on inside you and vice versa. You know, I took my two boys to it. They were not that crazy about it. I think maybe it's really good for preteens, particularly preteen girls. But I just thought it was such a brilliant piece of storytelling and filmmaking. It's a beautiful film.
Kristen, your top movie of the year was Room. It's based on the best-selling novel by Emma Donoghue.
Truck. Wiggle out. Jump. Run. Somebody.
I'm scared.
I know. I'm gonna be there in your head talking to you the whole time.
Truck. Wiggle out. Jump when the truck slows down. Run. Somebody.
That's Room, Kristen Meinzer.
Oh, this movie is so haunting and so beautiful. It's about a mother and son who are living in a very small room, and they have their own language and their own reality for this little room they've lived in for years and years and years. On his fifth birthday, she reveals to him they were kidnapped years ago. They're being held captive there. She tries to escape by enlisting him, sending him out into the world. And it's so incredibly moving. I sobbed for about 80% of this movie. And to me, there's no better endorsement for a film than I cried nonstop and spent days afterward crying.
Kristen Meinzer's top three, The Room, Grandma, and Mad Max Fury Road. Rafer agrees Mad Max Fury Road. Also Revenant with Leonardo DiCaprio and Inside Out from Pixar, the top movies of the year. It is the end of the year, so now we're back to trivia. Of course, you knew I wasn't going to forget this. This is New Year's Eve edition, this famous New Year's Eve scene in a famous movie. Listen.
Ahora nombro un gobierno provisional. Salud. Salud. Salud.
Kristen Meinzer, that is New Year's Eve in what film?
The Omen?
Not even close. Rafer.
Is that Scarface?
Wrong. I'm sorry. That is Godfather 2. The famous New Year's Eve scene, 1959, in Havana as the revolution mounts. Listen.
I know it was you, Fredo. You broke my heart.
That's when they're at the party. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer here at the Takeaway, the Movie Date team. Kristen, I'm so sorry for you. You didn't get trivia right, but Happy New Year to both of you.
Thanks, Todd.
Thanks, Todd.
Here's something to take with you today. Some very generous Norwegians are campaigning to give part of a mountain to their neighboring nation, Finland. The gift would give Finland a new highest point. In order to make it happen, the borders between the two countries actually have to change slightly, just a few hundred feet to the north and the east of the current borders. However, the gift would commemorate Finland's 100th anniversary of independence in 2017. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. It's been a pleasure. Happy New Year to you. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, working to find cures for leukemia, lymphoma, Hodgkin's disease, and myeloma, improve the quality of life for patients and their families, and ensure access to treatments for patients. LLS.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.